This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Damien Carrick with you. Welcome to the Law Report. Here's a tricky question. Should drug-addicted children be forced into secure rehabilitation centres? It's an idea being debated in both South Australia and in Victoria. In South Australia, the state government has a short 9-page bill currently before Parliament. Meanwhile, in Victoria, a children's court magistrate who completed a Churchill Fellowship has over time built a broad support base for a secure therapeutic facility. And this broad-based group is hoping to convince the Victorian government of the merits of its proposal. So, why is mandatory drug rehab for kids being considered? And what's the best approach? The top-down approach adopted in South Australia, or the incremental, from-the-ground-up conversations and consultations currently taking place in Victoria? Here is Victorian Children's Court Magistrate Jenny Bowles. She's speaking here in her capacity as a Churchill Fellow, not as a judicial officer.
Many of the children we see in the child protection system have had terrible exposure to trauma and abuse. Their parents may also have substance abuse issues or mental health issues. They have therefore had poor role models. I can give you an example. A 12-year-old girl who's in love with a 33-year-old boyfriend who's found in motels with him. Self-harms. She drinks vodka and bourbon. She's tried heroin, acid, methamphetamines since she was 11, and she's been smoking cannabis since she is 8. She has bruising on her arms from her intravenous drug use, and over 100 warrants have been issued since last year for this young person who is missing from care. And when we don't know where she is, the child protection apply to the court for an emergency care warrant for the police to try to locate her. She's now engaging in criminal activity. She agreed to engage in drug and alcohol counselling and then promptly absconded, so there was no treatment received.
Tell me about a young boy called Greg who came before you a year or two ago.
So seeing these children with significant substance abuse issues, unfortunately I see them every day at court, and it was Greg's case which ultimately resulted in me applying for the Churchill Fellowship. He wasn't involved in the child protection system. He had a very loving mother, and his mother would come to court each time to support him. He didn't come before the court until he was 17, and he came before the court because he had been stealing bottles of vanilla essence from the supermarket. Vanilla essence has a very high alcohol content, almost 40%, and he'd been using cannabis for many, many years. He'd been admitted as an inpatient in a psychiatric facility because he had an emerging psychosis, and he came before me for shop theft. Ordinarily for shop theft, you would not be detained in custody, particularly for the price of vanilla essence. He would continue to attend at the same supermarket. The supermarket would contact the police would attend, they would charge him. Ultimately, because he continually reoffended, he ended up in custody. He was assaulted whilst he was in custody. He wasn't streetwise at all. And I watched as his life was spiralling out of control. On one occasion, his mother was so desperate, she nailed the windows to try to stop him going out to use. He assaulted her. The police were called. An intervention order was taken out. And then he was excluded from the home. He had the most committed mother you could ever have. And on one occasion when she was at court, when she was so concerned about her son's health, she said to me, "What can you do? I'm watching my son die before my eyes." And I thought, I'm meant to be in a position where I can do something. The Children's Court philosophy is very much on giving young people another opportunity, looking at rehabilitation. But when I look at the lack of hope in so many young people's eyes, when I say to them, you need to go and see a drug and alcohol counsellor, and that would usually involve them attending for an assessment appointment, and then upon them giving the counsellor a self-report about their use, and you could question how reliable that might be, they may be advised, well, you need to come and have counselling. That counselling usually involves 1 hour a week. And the chaotic lifestyle that these young people leave, and we've seen them in the parks, at the shopping centres, they're not at school, they're not engaged. Using becomes the whole focus of their day. To expect them to get on a tram or a train and go and visit a counsellor to deal with terribly difficult underlying reasons for why they're using, often due to trauma and abuse, I think is expecting too much of them. And whilst for some young people they will engage, and I want to make it very plain from the outset, I'm not critical of the voluntary treatment regime, there are some young people who engage and who engage very well because we know counselling treatment works. But for the young people I'm referring to, they're so damaged, they're so vulnerable, and they are not engaging and therefore not receiving any treatment.
Magistrate Jenny Bowles, what options do you currently have available to you when kids like the ones you've been describing appear before you in court?
So we can include on child protection orders requirements for the young person to engage in counselling. We have detox beds in Victoria. Again, it's a voluntary treatment regime. So going back to Greg, the young boy that I mentioned earlier with the vanilla essence problem, on three occasions we organised for him to attend a detox facility. And he wanted to go. He physically attended at the detox facilities, and on each and every occasion, he only lasted a few hours. Such was the pull of his substance abuse, and he ended up back before me in court because he reoffended. In addition to detox facilities, which are voluntary, we also have some residential facilities for young people. For example, Birribee, Baruna, Bunjilawarra. But again, they are all voluntary. So if a young person decides it's all too hard or it's too painful, they just leave.
There is something called secure welfare, mm-hmm. where if you're worried about the welfare of a kid, maybe like that young girl, that 12-year-old who's spending time with a 33-year-old serious drug user who's exploiting her, can you make an order saying you have to go to mandatory secure residential care?
Currently in Victoria, we have a girls' home in Maribyrnong, which has 10 beds for the state of Victoria, and we have the boys' equivalent in Ascot Vale, and that has 10 beds as well. And yes, we do have the power. This is in the child protection side of the court. When there is a significant risk of harm to the child or to others, we can make an order placing them in secure welfare. Secure welfare, they're both homes. They cannot leave, so they are secure. The court has the power to make one order for up to 21 days is the maximum period of time, and that can be extended for a further period of 21 days.
So it's a maximum of 42 days?
Correct. It involves an opportunity for the young person to come out of the community because they're in such a perilous state. It involves assessments being able to take place. For example, psychiatric assessments, or if there's a concern a young girl might be pregnant, other drug and alcohol assessments would take place. But then upon being released from secure welfare, the voluntary system kicks in again, and the expectation is that the young person will engage. The young girl that I referred to, she'd had 13 stints in secure welfare.
And of course, if these kids are offending people like Greg, I mean, you could of course send them to juvenile detention. Again, that gets them off the street. But is there any effective, meaningful treatment for drug and alcohol treatment for a child in a youth detention centre?
There certainly are some services in there, particularly if they're undergoing a sentence. The difficulty is that as a result of the research I conducted overseas on my Churchill Fellowship, it was loud and clear that in a detention centre, which is primarily there for punishment, we've reached the end of the road when we get to that point, whilst there is a school at Parkville, for example, and at Malmesbury, there are attempts, of course, to continue to rehabilitate. It is a draconian environment. It's effectively a juvenile prison. One of the psychiatrists I spoke to in England said, you won't be able to affect change and rehabilitate in that type of environment. You can't engage in meaningful therapeutic work if you're hypervigilant and worried about perhaps being assaulted. That's why, in my view, yes, it takes them off the street, but it's my view that a lot of the reason for why these children are using requires a health and a welfare response. It doesn't require a punitive justice response.
These are the suite of options available to you, and you've thought very deeply about this, and you now think that the children's courts should be given the power to make an order that a child have mandatory residential drug treatment. What would that look like?
So what it would look like is that the court was satisfied that the child had very serious substance abuse issues, that the child had had an opportunity to engage in the voluntary treatment regime, and for whatever reason, they couldn't or wouldn't engage. Most importantly, if the court made that youth therapeutic order, the court just wouldn't walk away. That would not be the finish of it. It would not be the sentence, or it would not be the final order in child protection. Rather, it would be an opportunity for the young person to engage in their rehabilitation, and there would be constant monitoring by the court. of their progress within the youth therapeutic facility.
So there'd be checks and balances, there'd be judicial oversight.
Yes.
Presumably the child would have legal representation.
Yes.
Their legal representatives could appeal a decision by somebody like you.
Ultimately, the actual model would be a matter for government, but there are certainly the means by which checks and balances would be built in, yes.
And what are you proposing, a maximum of how many months?
Well, the evidence we heard overseas was that it takes 4 to 6 months to effect change. In some cases, longer. Ultimately, again, that would be a matter for government. But in my model, it would not be 4 to 6 months in a secure facility, so I need to make that very plain. My model is that initially the young person would be placed in the secure facility. It's not bars on the windows, it's not concrete walls. It's examples that I saw overseas where it can be homely and welcoming and respectful in a medical clinical model. The young person would detox, so unlike Greg, who couldn't remain at the detox facility, he wouldn't be able to leave. He would commence a therapeutic relationship with the clinicians there. Reports would be provided back to the court regarding the young person's progress. And then on the same site, there would be step-down facilities which would very much mirror the current residential facilities that we have, with the same clinicians working through with the young person from the secure facility to the residential facility. And as I saw in every country I visited, education and training facilities on site. So this is an opportunity for these young people to deal with the underlying reasons for why they're using, and also to meaningfully engage in education and training. And then ultimately there would need to be a very planned transition back to the community. And I saw examples in Sweden as to how that could be done. I also saw examples in New Zealand. But it's most important that the money that is spent in relation to these young people, there has to be that equivalent funding when the young people transition back to the community, or the risk is they will just revert to their old ways. And I don't pretend this will work for every young person. I'm not Pollyanna. But I think when I see the young people before me with no hope in their eyes, they put their hoodie up as they leave court and they look at me as if to say, do you really think I'm going to engage voluntarily? And I feel like as a community, we have an obligation to intervene as early as possible to help these young people.
People listening to this might think there's a risk that unless it's properly resourced, places like Sweden, very affluent, high level of public expenditure, people listening to this might think there's a risk that unless these sorts of facilities are properly resourced, this could simply degenerate into just another form of juvenile detention.
And that's why I can't emphasise enough that unless it is properly resourced, unless it is a medical clinical model, unless all of the critical elements I've included in my report are there, I wouldn't want to put my name to it.
I'm wondering, for very, very, very good reasons, Indigenous Australians are profoundly sceptical and terrified of having their children institutionalised and separated from their families and from country. Do you recognise that there are special concerns or needs that have to be addressed with respect to Indigenous Australians or Indigenous Victorians?
Look, I absolutely do. And when I came back from the Churchill, one of the first people I wanted to speak to was the Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, Andrew Jacquemos.
I think he's moved on since.
He has moved on since. I have spoken to Justin Mohammed, who's the current Children's Commissioner, who gave us a very good hearing, and we're following up with a number of community organisations as a result of our discussions with him. So yes, of course, that's right. Aboriginal people, we look at the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. There is a real concern about detaining Aboriginal people, and young people included, of course. But what Aboriginal people also tell me is that they know what's happening with their young people. They are 13 times more likely than non-Aboriginal children to be in detention. They are 16 times more likely to be in out-of-home care and often not with family. They say to me, what can we do? Because the system is not working. We have young children in the regional parts of Victoria as young as 10 years of age on ICE. And I sit in the Children's Koori Court and elders will say to me, we must be able to do something better. Now, one of the critical elements in my report that I say have to be there is culture. And what I was able to observe overseas was a Māori facility for young people with substance abuse issues. I saw the value of culture in healing. We need to have community on board. We need to have it as close as possible to the country from which the young people are from, and for elders to have a key responsibility in assisting to reconnect a lot of these lost children to their culture.
Why not simply better fund voluntary treatments for kids? It's been put to me that kids are often very reluctant or sceptical about treatment because they've been exposed to it before, they've been sent to it before, and it's not very good. Why not put in the resources at the front end rather than this kind of mandatory scheme at the back end?
Well, I don't see it as an either-or option. I totally support more resources being put towards young people and their substance abuse issues in the voluntary treatment sector. But I just rhetorically ask, what do we do with these children who are not engaging at all? Isn't it better to intervene at an early age whilst they are still children rather than the trajectory that we know many of these young people are on, which is they'll be non-productive members of our community, they'll be in hospitals, in psych wards, they'll end up in adult custody. The young people using ICE now are 11 times more likely than those who are not using ICE to experience psychotic episodes.
And how big a problem is ICE in the community and amongst kids at the moment?
It's very big in what we see at court. We see it not only in the children, but when supervised urine drug screens are done by the parents who are in the child protection system, ICE is featuring very, very prominently. And it's the effect we're seeing of ICE on the offending too, in terms of the violence and the psychosis, which is really, really troubling.
Jenny Bowles, Magistrate of the Victorian Children's Court, speaking there in her capacity as a Churchill Fellow, not as a judicial officer. I'm Damien Carrick, and on RN or available as a podcast, this is The Law Report. Today we're asking, should we have mandatory drug rehab for kids? While conversations and consultations continue slowly in Victoria, in South Australia, there's currently a 9-page bill before the state parliament. Penny Wright is South Australia's guardian for children and young people. She also has an oversight role for kids in detention. She has grave concerns about this bill.
Late last year, the government introduced a bill called the Controlled Substances Youth Treatment Orders Amendment Bill. And in the bill, the government's proposing that the youth court in South Australia can make orders to compel a child or young person to undergo mandatory treatment for a drug dependency. At this stage, it doesn't cover alcohol dependency and it doesn't cover cannabis. That compulsion would be for the child or young person to be in a residential facility for mandatory treatment for their dependency for a period of up to 12 months. And there are very few human rights protections in that bill.
So specifically, what concerns do you have about this legislation?
I was astounded to see that the government introduced the bill with no model of care included in that bill. So what should be the linchpin of a system of compulsory treatment for drug dependency, that is the means of treatment that's being proposed to treat these young people, is just not there in the bill. And basically it's like the government asking the parliament to sign a blank cheque. So they're saying pass this bill to enable the detention of young people as young as 10 for a period up to 12 months, and then we'll come up with a place for them to go and the treatment they will receive once it's passed. So detention of children and young people should be a last resort, but that isn't the case. Compulsory treatment for drug dependency can't be said to be a last resort when there are far too few voluntary drug and alcohol treatment options for children and young people in South Australia at the moment. So we have children and young people, kids who are desperately needing and wanting help, who can't necessarily get it. And my view is that if young people could get effective help and treatment when they first need it, then it's certainly arguable that there'd be less need for a mandatory system like this at the end of that time, because dependency becomes more entrenched, not less entrenched over time.
Penny Wright, what's been the response of South Australia's peak Aboriginal health body?
They're saying that we have a risk of another stolen generation, essentially, because as in every other jurisdiction in Australia, Aboriginal children and young people are disproportionately affected both in the out-of-home care system and also the youth justice system. There's a real concern that it's children from Aboriginal backgrounds that are more likely to come to the attention of the youth court in this kind of scenario and end up being detained for periods of up to 12 months. Detained, I say advisedly, because essentially it is a deprivation of liberty, even if the basis for it is for treatment of a drug dependency.
Penny Wright, are you familiar with the proposal for youth therapeutic orders, which has been put forward by Victorian Children's Court Magistrate Jenny Bowles? How does it, in your view, differ from the South Australian proposal? And what is your view of the Victorian proposal?
Yes, well, I was looking at Magistrate Bowles' paper, and it's very interesting and very, very nuanced, I noticed. That some of the things that Jenny Bowles requires from this kind of compulsory system would be that the facilities need to be welcoming and therapeutic. And she talks about them having a homely feel. So it's absolutely essential that they're not characterised in any way that's punitive. She says that there needs to be high quality staff, and that when the treatment has finished, there needs to be aftercare and careful transition back to the community. Because, of course, we know that the children and young people often come from circumstances that lead them into drug dependency or alcohol dependency. And so just returning them without any supports to the community would possibly be setting them up to fail. So if we're going to have a compulsory treatment system in South Australia, we need to have a model of care that's designed and based on strong evidence about what actually works, and it has to be properly resourced.
What I find absolutely fascinating is that in Victoria, a whole bunch of organisations are members of Magistrate Jenny Bowles' steering committee to promote this idea in Victoria. VADA, the Victorian Alcohol and Drug Association, VACHO, the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, the three leading service providers, WISAS, Odyssey House, Windana, and there are psychiatrists, addiction specialists, lawyers, those with lived experience of addiction, they're all part of her steering committee to kind of explore how we might do this properly. Yet many of those same organisations or their equivalents in South Australia are vehemently opposed to what's being proposed in South Australia. How do you account for that difference between South Australia and Victoria?
I think that comes back to the fundamental basis of the way the legislation has been developed. In my view, it's totally undercooked. It just hasn't been carefully thought through. So we're talking about deprivation of liberty for up to 12 months, which arguably there's no basis for why it has to be so long. When the bill was introduced, there was no provision for legal advice or representation for the young person coming before the youth court. I'm not necessarily totally opposed to mandatory treatment in some circumstances when it's been done properly. But there has to be high quality voluntary services first so that young people can get the help when they need it, right when they need it, and not be at a situation where lots of young people can't get help at all, and then we're actually going to be prepared to compel some young people to receive mandatory treatment in some circumstances.
Finally, Penny Wright, where is this legislation up to in South Australia?
Well, when the government first introduced this bill last year, they were trying to push it through very, very quickly. But there certainly has been a lot of concerns raised by most of the groups in the community who understand the issue very well, the Australian Medical Association, Drug and Alcohol Services of South Australia, and so on, and particularly too, those who know about children and young people and what they need. And my understanding is that the government's considering some further amendments, and I've also heard that they're developing a model of care now, but I'm not aware of any consultation that's occurred with any of the groups that I'm talking to at this point, and it seems to me that it's not likely to be passed within the next few weeks, the Parliament sitting.
Penny Wright, South Australia's guardian for children and young people. So what do people who spend their days working with troubled kids think about this idea of mandatory drug rehab? Peter Stockton is a drug and alcohol worker with the Victorian Youth Support and Advocacy Service, known as WISAS.
I was in secure welfare this morning working with a 14-year-old young man who had just come out of a Melbourne-based hospital because he'd suffered a significant overdose drinking large amounts of bourbon combined with Xanax, which is a benzodiazepine, and cannabis use, and became unconscious. Fortunately for him, he was around a group of friends who saw that this situation was fairly appalling because he was starting to cough up blood, and called the ambulance. And that young person was then taken to the local hospital. And then from there, child protection were involved, and that young person was placed in secure welfare.
And secure welfare is, I think, for 21 days, right?
That's right.
So you can engage with them during this 21-day period. But if they, at the end of that, they're back out on the street, mm-hmm. they choose not to engage with you, that's it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Magistrate Jenny Bowles from the Victorian Children's Court, she's putting forward this idea of mandatory residential drug treatment. She says that this is another option that we need. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would work for this 14-year-old?
I think that it will work for some 14-year-olds. I know that the young man that I was talking to this morning understands the gravity of the overdose and doesn't want to be ever in that situation again. Will he stop drug use? I don't think so, because he's got so many particular issues that need to be addressed other than the drug use. And that's why he's using drugs in some ways. And those issues remain unaddressed and they need to be sorted out. If he was in a mandatory AOD treatment service, I think he would certainly have the time to start to address those issues. For instance, he hasn't been to school since year seven. And so there's a lot of education that is missed. He does have wishes and desires to, you know, become a tradie. And so there's lots of things that can be explored, lots of avenues and pathways that can be suggested for him. Is he in a position to listen to those? I'm not quite sure.
Is it worth giving it a go?
Oh, look, I think for some young people, absolutely.
Obviously, your views around this are very complex. It's not an easy or straightforward conversation. But, I mean, it's informed by you dealing with people who have subsequently made dreadful life choices or who have died.
Absolutely. Yeah. As drug and alcohol workers, that's what we deal with every day. It's the balance that we're trying to strike between upholding people's rights and, I guess, in some ways, thinking about their life and making some decisions on their behalf.
Peter Stockton, a drug and alcohol worker with the Victorian Youth Support and Advocacy Service. Tara, an adult, has an important perspective. For her entire adolescence, she was abused by an older man. From the age of 14 until 20, he supplied her with heavy drugs and she was drug dependent.
Well, I definitely think it would have been beneficial in my case. I wouldn't have liked it if you'd come in and taken me there at 14. I would have screamed blue murder.
So you think that if it's done right, it could be useful and beneficial for some people under 18?
I was in a situation in which I was getting abused and I was being fed drugs, and I desperately needed to have a connection to a community outside of that exploitative, manipulative, toxic, abusive place. So it would have just made a massive difference in my life if the HS that day when they came over had have taken me away. I mean, I don't speak for every disadvantaged young person. I don't want to speak for every disadvantaged young person. All I can say is that I would have definitely benefited from such a facility, so long as it's implemented in a very ethical way.
Next week on The Law Report, you'll hear more about Tara's extraordinary story, her survival, her insights, and the sentencing of her perpetrator to 9 years jail in December last year. That's The Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer Julian McKenzie. Don't forget you can listen to The Law Report anytime, anyplace by subscribing to our podcast at the ABC Listen app, or you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.